Ohio seniors make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. Enroll by December 7th.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, we're at a weird time in the sports calendar where the NFL season, well underway, starting to get a real good picture of who's good in the NFL, who's not good in the NFL. College football has thrown a wrinkle or thrown a wrench into the calendar by introducing the 12-team playoff, where normally at this time of the year, we're able to kind of, you know, pick four or five, six, eight teams that really have a chance to matter, and instead we're looking at 20 or 25. The NBA season's underway, but we don't have a big enough sample size yet to determine who's good, who's not good. And now we have the complication of the transfer portal in college football, where you've got players who are jumping into the portal midseason, losing the starting job, get in the portal. It used to be a little simpler, but I don't mind. As a sports radio show host and a sports columnist, I don't mind having a bunch of overlapping things in a sports calendar that probably hasn't felt right or normal since before the pandemic. I'm looking at this weekend's college games. We're going to get into those games. I'm looking at the NFL games, starting to get a picture of who's going to matter in the NBA. There's some teams that look really good after just a handful of games, and some others that look like they should already be thinking about rebuilding. We'll talk about the pretenders and the contenders in all sports in this segment. Stephen Vaughn's in the hot seat today. Stephen, right off the top, let's talk about contenders and pretenders, because I got a text message last night from a good friend of mine who's a Golden State Warriors fan who said to me, what are the Warriors' odds to win the Western Conference right now? What are the odds to win the NBA championship right now? And the Warriors, in case you're wondering, are starting this season with some renewed confidence and Buddy Hield in the lineup and Terry Stotts on the bench, who gives them an added dimension as an offensive coach. Who knows if Stotts, how long he'll be for this job or for this league, but Warriors looking all right. But contender or pretender? Can we start 9 games into the NBA season by declaring that the Golden State Warriors at 7-1 are looking pretty good in the West, along with Oklahoma City and Phoenix? Of course, in the East, people looking at Boston, expecting maybe that they might repeat, but here comes Cleveland now at 9-0 to start the season. It's way too early to declare pretenders and contenders, but I don't blame my friend, who's a Warriors fan, for going, gosh, this looks like a renewed, rejuvenated lineup. Steph Curry looks like he's got help. Buddy Hield looks like everything Klay Thompson wasn't a year ago. Yes, we'll get to the college football and the NFL on this subject, but I want to rip through the NBA just to start. Who are the contenders right now in the Western Conference? Who are the contenders in the East, in your mind?
Your friend is right. You got a reason to be excited about the Warriors at their 7-1 start. They just go on the road. They beat the Boston Celtics. And also, Steph Curry's been out a couple games. He had an injury. He's only played in 5 of these games, and the Warriors are looking good. Their defensive rating, number 2 in the NBA. I think you can say that they are a contender for now. It is still a little early, but for me, I would put them in the contender class. I think in the Western Conference, there's a clear-cut favorite, and that's the Oklahoma City Thunder. I think they are that much better than everybody right now. I think they have everything that you need on a basketball team, and they're winning games by a lot, and they are playing really elite defense way more than anybody else. So I think the Thunder are contenders. I would put the Warriors in there as well, and then I would put the Suns in there. I think the Suns have played really well, and Mike Budenholzer is their head coach. It's definitely an upgrade. So I think those 3 teams right now, with the Timberwolves right on the outside of that, for the Western Conference. In the East right now, I think right now it's Boston, and that's about it right now, as I've seen. I need to see Philadelphia get healthy, see how Embiid and Maxey and Paul George play together, but they'd be on the outside. And then Cleveland, I'm not necessarily buying them until they can win, you know, a big playoff series. You know, they won 1 series last year, and then they got crushed by the Celtics. I need to see them do it a little bit more before I count them in, and the Knicks, the same thing. I think we look at the NBA and you want to add all these stars, which is great. That's what you want to do. You want to get your, you know, as talented as you can. Even though they all went to Villanova, I still think it's going to take a little bit for them to get, you know, get used to one another playing in the NBA. So I'm not ready to rain on the Knicks and say that they're going to be a championship team yet.
So give me your short list of contenders.
For me, it's Boston, it's Oklahoma City, and it's Phoenix and Golden State.
That's your short list. Give me a clear pretender, and it has to be somebody like Cleveland. It comes to mind at 9-0, but don't quite trust it. Or a team like maybe Houston or Dallas that has got out of the gates okay, but don't quite trust it. Give me one pretender.
In the East, I would go Indiana. They're third right now, 4-4. The Eastern Conference, by the way, has two teams above 500, and that's it. And then so everyone else is really bad. But I say Indiana right now. They're in third. They don't play defense. They don't play defense at a high enough level. They don't have the high-end talent. Tyrese Halliburton, good, not great. So I would say they are a pretender. And I would say Houston, for sure. They're just a little too young right now. They also don't have that star go-to player. Like, Fred VanVleet's really good. Sengun's really good. But they just don't have, like, that go-to guy. But I think that they can get it at some point because they do have elite coaching, and they play really good defense. Ime Udoka is their head coach in Houston. I think he's great. I think Houston is a pretender this year, but in a couple years, if somebody can kind of step up and become that guy, I think Houston's right there. But for this year, I think they're pretenders.
All right, I'm going to pivot to the NFL, contenders and pretenders, because everybody will look at the division leaders or, obviously teams that are 6-2 and 5-3 and certainly the 8-0 Chiefs, and they'll go, okay, these are the contenders. But I see some pretenders out there. Washington Commanders at 7-2, not a contender in my mind. They are a pretender. I still feel like they have a long shot 20-1 feel to me, given their relative youth at the quarterback position. And I still am not used to seeing the Commanders, be a team that's formidable. And keep in mind, these teams that we're all picking high in the draft have soft schedules to start with, and they won't get a soft schedule come playoff team if they're there. So the Commanders, even though they're 7-2, out of the gates, nice start for them. That's great. It's encouraging. I still don't trust them, and I still wouldn't trust them to win a first-round playoff game, so I'm going to call them a pretender. On the contender side, I'm going to go, obviously, with Kansas City in the AFC. They look like they could contend. Baltimore, I trust them. I know how tough they are. I know the style of play they have. I love how physical they are. Buffalo, you have to consider, anytime Josh Allen's back there and Buffalo's back there, contenders. But that's it for me in the AFC. And in the NFC, look, it's a little harder because I expected the 49ers to be there, and they're not at the top of that heap. But I'm still gonna kind of loosely put them in this little group that I think could contend. That group would include the Detroit Lions. It would also include maybe the Minnesota Vikings, maybe. Not totally sold on them. So I like the Lions. I like the Vikings. And I like San Francisco in the NFC. And a lot of people talk about Philadelphia.
I was going to say, what about Philly?
I can't shake, they've won four in a row, but I can't shake what I saw last year from the Eagles. And I see echoes of that in this year. So I think the sample size, much like the NBA season, isn't big enough for me yet. Get back to me in a month. I could include the Philadelphia Eagles in that group, and I might drop the Vikings or somebody else out after seeing a little more football. Is it wrong of me not to include the Atlanta Falcons, though? Like, I keep looking at the Falcons. I don't love their defense. I don't, they underwhelm me at times, and yet they're sitting there on top of the NFC South at 6-3, and, maybe I should give them more respect, but I think I've mentioned the teams that are going to get to the Super Bowl and potentially win the Super Bowl. I think it's Detroit. I think it's San Francisco. I think it could be Minnesota. I think it's Kansas City. I think it's Baltimore. I think it's Buffalo. I don't think anybody else is getting to the Super Bowl or winning the Super Bowl. And that's my take. How about you? Contenders and pretenders.
Yeah, contenders in the AFC is the Chiefs, obviously, for obvious reasons. I'm going to put Baltimore in there. I think Lamar is playing at an MVP level. I think they're good enough. And you know, hopefully they figure out the playoffs, but they're a contender than the Bills. I just love Josh Allen as well and that coaching staff. I think those are the only three contenders right now I would put in the AFC as pretenders in the AFC. I think the Steelers are the obvious one. They're good. They're not great. Their ceiling is definitely capped with what they have. And right now, I think the Texans are as well. I think they're squeaking by in that bad division. Their offensive line isn't healthy. Their playmakers aren't healthy. I think that they are a pretender when it comes to actually making it to the Super Bowl. In the NFC, I'm with you. The Falcons are a pretender. For me, like, I look at who they've beaten. They beat the Eagles in week two by 1 point, and that's it. They lost to the Seahawks by a bunch. They lost to the Chiefs, who were good. They lost to the Steelers, who were good. Besides that, they beat the Panthers, the Bucks, the Cowboys. Those aren't good wins. I'm not buying into the Falcons quite yet. I'm with you. The Niners, they're a contender. The Commanders, not a contender. The Lions are a contender. I want to put the Packers, but they just lost to the Lions at home. If you can't beat them at home, who are you going to beat? So I think right now for me in the NFC, the contenders are the 49ers and the Lions, and that's it. I can't trust the Eagles, just like you. Sirianni, no, thank you, not yet. So I think it's the Lions and the Niners, the real teams in the NFC, with the Lions ahead of everybody.
Yeah, last year when I watched Philadelphia against San Francisco, you could see that they just exposed something that wasn't right. And The narrative was that, they didn't just beat the Eagles, they broke the Eagles. And I still don't think that's fixed. I still see some echoes of, and whispers of what was there last year towards the end of the year. Maybe it's as simple as they just lost, they lost too many guys at the point of attack with Kelsey's retirement and all that stuff. But I'm looking at the Eagles and I don't see a contender. I just see a team that kind of is going to hang around, might make the playoffs, not really a threat to win it. And I would put them alongside the Commanders in the NFC as those teams. Now, pivot to college football. I think real easy to see contenders and pretenders when you look at the latest rankings that came out. I'm going to start with the contenders. The contenders, the Oregon Ducks. I think Oregon at 9-0, I said this yesterday, there's a feeling around the Ducks that I have right now, the undefeated Ducks that I've never had. I didn't have it in 2015. I didn't feel this way in 2011. I feel like Oregon could win this thing. And the first time I thought that was last weekend at Michigan Stadium. I was watching Oregon. They were just businesslike in dismantling Michigan on the road. And I expected maybe that Michigan would be at least a physical match in some ways for Oregon, and the Wolverines weren't. And so it looked to me like there was a distinct head and shoulders confidence I have in Oregon feel that makes me believe that Oregon could win this thing. And so I'm going to say Oregon's a contender. If I'm going to say Oregon's a contender, I have to say Ohio State's a contender, because they were right there with the Ducks at Autzen Stadium. If they had one more second or one more play, they may have beat Oregon, and we might be sitting here, talking about, Oregon being the number two team in the country instead of the number one team in the country. But I think Oregon and Ohio State are in that group. I think Georgia's in that group. And I think after that, it gets real thin for me. I don't think anybody else could win it. I think it's Oregon, Ohio State, Georgia. Those are the contenders. You want to talk pretenders? You have to bring up Miami, undefeated, 9-0. I don't see it. I think they're fun. I think they have a nice offense. I still think Mario Cristobal will cost them a game with some of his coaching decisions at some point. And I think they're really lucky to be 9-0. They could be 2-loss Miami right now, instead of 9-0. So they have pretender written across their chest right now. Texas, same thing. I saw them against Georgia. I can't unsee that. Penn State, saw it against Ohio State. I worry about Penn State's psyche going into this weekend's game, this Saturday night's game, the whiteout in Happy Valley, where you've got Penn State trying to get back on track against a Washington team that hasn't been very good on the road this year. And I think it could be a little bit of a dicey game for James Franklin. That's a pretender to me, even though they're a playoff team. Indiana's pretender. They haven't played anybody. They haven't beaten anybody. They may not beat anybody this season. BYU's a pretender. I was looking back at BYU's wins. Look, I think it's great. They're having a nice season, but 8-0? I won't be surprised if Utah gets them this week in the Holy War. Notre Dame, you lost to Northern Illinois. Pretender. Alabama, you already lost twice. Pretender. Boise State, nice team, but you're in that next group for me. Like, you're a playoff team, but I can't see Boise State winning it. So to me, this is a three-team race in college football. It's Oregon, it's Ohio State, it's Georgia. There's nobody else.
I'm with you. There's three distinct teams that are above everybody: Georgia, Oregon, Ohio State, whatever order you want to put them in. Oregon should be number one. I think Georgia's the best team in the nation. If I had to pick, I would put Texas in the contenders as well. They did it last year. I know they got destroyed by Georgia at home, but I look at Quinn Ewers, I look at Sark. I think I trust those guys. They're really good. They got to the college football playoff last year, just the four teams. I still do trust Texas with that offense. They are loaded. I would put them in a contender. Everyone else is pretenders. There's holes in all these teams, even the top three teams, even Oregon, Ohio State, Georgia. There's holes in those teams. I don't think that they are, I don't think they're head and shoulders above everybody, but they are distinctly ahead of people. But you can catch them on a certain day and beat that team, beat those teams. So I think those three, and then I would add Texas as the only other contender to win the championship.
I think it's going to be fun, though. I mean, the 12-team playoff is going to make us wonder. And, of course, you have to stay healthy. I think all these teams, Oregon is, one injury away at the wrong position from, falling out of that top group. They need Dylan Gabriel healthy. Ohio State, their offensive line, I have not been impressed with their offensive line this season. Doesn't look like the typical Ohio State offensive line. They have to sustain this season. And, if Penn State had been a little better in the goal line, we might be having a different conversation today.
Or Nebraska. Nebraska almost got Ohio State at Ohio State.
Yeah. And Nebraska has had a couple of moments this season where, the way that they handled Colorado was interesting to me. And then they just haven't been the same. They haven't played a complete game. And, I've seen some great defensive effort from them, but I haven't seen a complete game outside of the Colorado game. So, I mean, there's just a bunch of those teams where I feel like, and Georgia's my third one. Like, as good as Georgia has been, there have just been some moments where first half against Florida, the Kentucky game, there have just been some moments where I go, gosh, if they don't play their best game, they get beat. And I think, we have not felt that way over the years about Alabama, Georgia, and Ohio State in a playoff scenario. Like, it has been, hey, if they play their B game, they probably can still win. But this is not that kind of tournament this year. So if Oregon doesn't show up and play its best game, Oregon's going to get beat in a quarterfinal or semifinal. They won't even get to the title game. Same for Georgia. Like, the teams they're going to face are going to be better than Florida, better than Kentucky. You better bring it. And so I think that's what's going to be fun about the playoff is we're going to get a chance to really kind of immerse ourselves in a true playoff. Like, I don't think we're going to get the same fun we get watching a 12 seed beat a 5 seed in an NCAA tournament bracket. It's not going to be that wild. But I think you could find some really kind of wonky things in the opening round games where you might see a road team win a game against a higher seeded opponent. But I think when we get down to the final four, when we get to the semifinals, I would be really surprised if we don't see Oregon, Ohio State, and Georgia all sitting in the semifinals. And who is that fourth team? I don't know. Yeah. That fourth team could be the outlier.
Yeah, because you're right on that. Like, it wouldn't be shocking if Penn State were to upset Oregon or Georgia in a playoff game, but we don't think that they are good enough to win three or four games in a row to win the national championship, where I think Oregon, Ohio State, Georgia is, but I also could see them losing to Boise State in the first round, and it wouldn't be shocking. I think this is a very, very very, very interesting season where this isn't going to happen a lot, where these top teams are clearly better than these other teams, but we also are not going to be shocked if they lost in the first round or the second round. But if they can survive that first game, it is like the NCAA tournament in that way, where I think if they can survive that first round, their first game, they're looking good. Then they get to the, the final four or the national championship game.
A little bit later in the show, we'll give our picks for the weekend and start to talk about the games. And before that, though, I want to point out, like, Dan Lanning came out and he had to talk yesterday and earlier this week about, on Monday, about scoring that touchdown against Michigan late in the game. People may remember Oregon had the ball in the 7-yard line. There was about a minute 15 to go in the game. Dylan Gabriel could have snapped the ball, could have taken a knee, then snapped the ball one more time. The game's over. Lanning kind of justified it in a way that maybe he was expecting, I think, more of a pushback. But he justified it by saying, hey, we don't know if they're going to take a timeout there. And if they do take a timeout, then we have to run a play. But I think the better explanation came on Tuesday when the committee revealed the rankings, and the committee obviously factored margin of victory and game control into the rankings. Like, how are you winning? How in control do you look doing it? What were those final scores? To a certain extent, margin of victory is going to matter. And so I kind of think, and I'm kind of looking at the last month of this season, as the rankings are unveiled, I do think we're going to see some teams that have the ball inside the red zone at the end of games pour it on a little bit, because I think, you know, they're all going, hey, if we're not a conference champion, we have to be worried about seeding. We have to be worried about margin of victory. We have to look as good as we possibly can. And one of the byproducts of these giant conferences with 16 teams or 18 teams is that I'm finding it really difficult to see, kind of get a feel for who's good and who's not good. And it keeps coming up on this show. Like, one of our callers brought it up yesterday or day before as we were talking about, you know, is Ohio State any good? Have they played anybody? Is Oregon any good? You know, they played each other, but have they played anybody else? Is Georgia good? Like, who have they played? Like, when we start to do these cross comparisons to find out which teams are good and which teams are not good, I think one of the negative byproducts of 16 and 18 teams in a conference is that you don't have a lot of this common opponent crossover. And so I'm watching, like, you know, Arizona State playing Kansas State or Oklahoma State, and I'm trying to look at common opponents of Texas Tech and Cincinnati, and I'm trying to figure out, okay, how good are these teams? How should I expect them to play, you know, against each other when I can't find common opponents? Or there's one common opponent, but it was in week three of the season. And so I think we are going to have a lot of posturing and a lot of running up of the score as it pertains to these contenders, these teams that are in the top 25 or so. I think all are going to be like on the runway, got their best clothes on, smiling, you know, this is a beauty pageant. And so, like, when Washington State is playing a game against Utah State on Saturday night, I'm kind of expecting Washington State to not just want to win the game, but they need to win it in a way that tells the committee, like, hey, we're really good. And I think the same goes for Boise State. The same goes for even Oregon playing, you know, games against, like, teams like Maryland. Like, I think they have to, I think everybody needs to go pedal to the metal right now, because you want to show the committee, not only are you beating this team that's in front of you, the other thing you can control is, how much can I win this game by? How in control do we look? Because the committee, I think, is really going to be relying on that stuff, maybe a little more than in some other years, given that there's not a lot of crossover. You know, a great example, the Big Ten, Oregon, Indiana, and Penn State, you know, they all could have been undefeated and not played each other. Like, it's absurd to me that, like, you could have ended up in a situation where you go, oh, you know, who goes to the conference title game? We have three undefeated teams, and, you know, and really maybe Ohio State is the second best team. Nobody knows. Like, so it's just really hard because there's not enough crossover. And so I'm really expecting this week in particular to see some coaches that are in some situations where they can win the game and pour it on. I think we're going to see some big numbers this week, and I think we're going to see some heavy favorites cover, because I think they are more aware than ever that the committee's looking at this stuff. All right, Jaden Robinson, Oregon State defensive back. He's been out with a concussion several weeks. He's making his triumphant return to the field this week. He's going to join us in the next segment. The interview is brought to you by Jamba. Life is better blended. Oregon State team captain Jaden Robinson talking about his return and San Jose State and maybe some bowling coming up. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Every Thursday this college football season, we have been visited by Jaden Robinson, Oregon State team captain and defensive back. This interview is presented by our friends at Jamba, your local Jamba. Life is better blended. Jaden Robinson has been out. It's a concussion. He's getting back into the lineup, and it's going to be great to have him back on this show talking about getting back into the lineup. Jaden Robinson joining us from Corvallis, Oregon, on campus.
How are we doing?
Yeah, look, you're back in the lineup. You're healthy. A couple weeks ago, you said this was the game. Are you tracking to play, to be in uniform on Saturday?
Yes, sir. I can't wait. I'll be out there suited and ready to go.
What has it been like for you? Because, you know, I know for the rest of us, you know, everybody's, you know, kind of watches football on a week-to-week basis, but you're used to being on the field. How hard has it been for you to kind of be on the sideline or have to not make a trip or be with your team?
It's definitely been, you know, irritating watching games, you know, knowing I could be out there helping my team in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, like with the injury I had, I couldn't be there. But they know that I was supporting them from the sideline. But honestly, yeah, I just can't wait to get back and play and help the team.
You know, when you look at San Jose State and what they've done, and I've seen them play a couple times, they're going to challenge you guys. They've got some receivers. They've got a couple quarterbacks that'll play that are a little different. But they're going to come after you guys. Is that a more fun game for a defensive back or a corner where you're challenged like that?
Definitely. I can't wait. Especially me. This is my first game back. I can't wait. I'm ready to go. So especially for the guys, too. You know, we know that they're going to pass the ball. We got to stop the run first. But, you know, they get the ball in the air. I think our guys are ready to deal. So we've been practicing, having good practices all week.
You know, I asked your coach yesterday, you know, he said when he was a senior, it hit him in the second to last game where he went, gosh, I only get a couple more of these. And you and I have talked about this at different points of the season, but you're aware that you've got a limited number of games left, 4 in the regular season. You get a chance to make them count. How important are these games for you?
They're definitely important, but, you know, like I said, like I just like to go out there and have fun. You're going to definitely see me have the most fun I'm probably going to ever have on this field, you know, these last 4 games, 5 games. You know, so I can't wait. Like I said, I'm excited. I think this is one of those games for me where it's like, man, I know I only got 3 more after this. Like, I know I got to guarantee 3 more after this, you know. So, I just can't wait to get him in. I can't wait to play this Saturday.
San Jose State has played 2 different quarterbacks. Number 5, Walter Egett. Number 9, Emmett Brown. You probably identify him by numbers when you're watching film. But are they different? Are they different kinds of passers? Are they're running the same scheme, but how different are those two guys when you see them on the field?
I mean, in terms of their scheme, I think they're kind of both the same. You know, all their QBs look to get through the ball. You know, 3's the best. 3's their best receiver on the team. You know, I know a couple of the guys on the other team, you know, so like, I didn't really notice a difference in QBs, you know, but other than they want to get the ball to 3, so we'll see how that goes. But I think they're both in the same basket right now.
Yeah, Nick Nash, number 3, their leading receiver and one of the top receivers in the country statistically. He had a big game against Washington State early in the season. When you watch film, you know, you're probably getting a whole bunch of different games. How has San Jose State evolved as a team this season?
You know, I think they moved 3 to the slot, you know, Nick Nash, where last year, you know, we played him. I played him personally, so I know his game. You know, they moved him to the slot for a reason. You know, really, outside of that, that's really all.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because sometimes you put a guy in that slot position because you're trying to find different ways to get him the ball and you can move him around a little bit. And let's do a little football 101 for our audience. You know, as a defensive back, how do you, how do you deal with, you know, when they put a guy in the slot who is their playmaker, and, you know, as a defense, you have to be mindful of him.
You know, if he's their number one and he's in the slot and he's moving and they got a motion in the cross formations, moving, ball's probably going to him. Like, that's just football 101. Motion guy who mainly is their guy on the team, he's most likely going to get the ball, especially in critical times in the game, crucial downs, crucial third downs. You know, got to have a situation. They're definitely motioning guys. They're definitely, when he's at 1, you know, he's not normally lined up at 1 because he's their slot receiver this year. So, you know, just a lot of film study stuff that I've been going over, but that's mainly just that football 101. I can't get too into depth on the phone.
Yeah, sure.
So,
of course. We're talking to Jaden Robinson on this great Thursday. This interview presented by Jamba. Life is better blended. We'll get to your favorite Jamba in a minute, but last time out, San Jose State threw some interceptions. They threw 4 picks in the last game. I have to think, as a defensive back, when you know that the ball is going to be in the air and you can see on film that, hey, these guys have put the ball in the hands of the defense a few times, that you start to think in those terms. And I don't want to say you expect interceptions, but can you hunt for interceptions against a team like this?
Not necessarily. You know, you still have to play your game. You still got to have good eyes, feet, and hands, you know, as a DB. You still got to communicate. You still got to get the right call. You know, you still got to do all the fundamental stuff, all the little detail stuff, you know, to still be great and play great on Saturday. So, yeah, I want one to fall in my hands. I wish it this down the fourth, but I still got to go out there and do my job. I do my job, have good eyes, hands, and feet, the ball coming. So,
I'd like to see you get a couple, right? Like, and because here's why.
Oh, definitely.
Look, we've talked about you not leaving the field as a high school player. I'd like to see you get to play a little offense with the ball in your hands against these guys on offense that don't know how to tackle, right? Like, I think that's the most fun thing is when you see a defensive back who you can tell played running back or played receiver or played quarterback, who suddenly ends up with the football, and you got a bunch of offensive linemen trying to tackle him in space. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see it a couple times on Saturday.
I can't wait to show you.
Like, sometimes when a linebacker intercepts a pass, no offense to the linebackers, but you can see them, they're not looking to score. They're happy to have the interception. They're looking to get a few yards. And they run out of bounds sometimes. But when a DB who has played offense has the ball in their hands, that, like, you could see it back in the day with, Deion Sanders, Coach Prime. Like, he would get he's looking to score. Like, you know, it was being very opportunistic. So, love to see the Oregon State defense get in on the act. What Jamba have you been drinking lately?
You know, I still stay on my Fruity Pebble. You know, I just had a Belgian waffle yesterday. The one that I do want to try, though, is, like, the strawberry gummy. I've only heard of it. I've never seen anybody actually get it. So it's like a white gummy,
okay. But
a strawberry version. So I'm going to go find that out, and I'm going to let y'all know how that tastes next time.
What class do you have coming up right now? Because you got to get off to class here.
I got bowling class. I just had yoga class yesterday, but I got bowling today.
Love it. In bowling class today, are you working on anything, or are you guys just go out and you bowl and you play a couple games? How does that work?
Well, we bowl, you know, we learn basic mechanics, you know, the number of the pins. But for the most part, you know, we bowl our two games of the day and we're done pretty much. But for the most part, you got to bowl how you're supposed to bowl, you know, three finger. If you're a two-hand bowler, you got to bowl two hands. Can't bowl with just like two fingers, or just throw the ball down there, just curve it with no fingers in the holes, you know. So it's fun. You know, I got a teammate in that class, so, and we'd be competing. So, you know, it'd be fun.
All right, let's say you and I are competing, but you're down by a pin, but you got a 7-10 split. Are you trying to get both pins, or are you just trying to make sure you get one?
No, I'm definitely getting both. I'm hitting left side of the 7 to hit the 10. Definitely.
I love it. All right, Jaden Robinson, get on your way. I'll see you at the stadium, and we'll talk to you next week.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you guys.
And there he goes, off to bowling class to work on that 7-10 split. Jaden Robinson back in the lineup. The Beavers need as many healthy defensive players as they can get. It certainly helps in a game against a team like San Jose State that is going to put the ball in the air. It certainly helps to have your team captain and your best corner and your best defensive back on the field. So Robinson being back is a big, big deal for Oregon State's defense, particularly this week against a San Jose State team that I thought was going to be a little better. Like, when they played Washington State early in the year, took them to double overtime, I thought, oh, wow, San Jose State looks really good. They look fearless. Now they've got a quarterback controversy. They've got a quarterback who started the games early in the year, who has been replaced now, but they still bring the other guy back into the game. And one of the QBs threw his helmet on the sideline in frustration last time out 2 weeks ago against Fresno State. They had 4 interceptions combined against Fresno State. The ball's going to be in the air. I think there'll be some opportunities. We'll see if Oregon State can capitalize on that. I want to thank our friends at Jamba, who sponsor this interview every week. Steve and the team there, big fist bump to you guys. All right, coming up, we will talk about the big splash, the one big thing going on today. Plus, we have Punch and Audio coming up top of the hour. And who let the dogs out? Well, I'll tell you in the 4 o'clock hour. Leave it here. That's a tease, folks. Leave it here.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Steven, we're going to get into all of our picks for the weekend games in the 4 o'clock hour. We'll also get a visit from our friend David Fry, who is the son of Jerry Fry, the former Oregon head football coach. David Fry joins us once a year on this program to talk a little bit about football and what it was like to grow up the son of a football coach, but also National Dog Show coming up on Thanksgiving. And NBC's got it, and David Fry, along with, Jay Peterman, whatever his name is, from Seinfeld, they do the National Dog Show. So David Fry will be coming up in the 4 o'clock hour to talk about that experience and what it was like to grow up the son of a football coach in the state of Oregon. Like, you know, maybe get a little glimpse into the into the life of a head football coach. But before we get into any of that, let's deal with Oregon State, because we just talked with Jaden Robinson in the last segment. I have said it. I think Beaver fans have said it. I think Beaver fans are nervous about Saturday's game against San Jose State, because there's the potential there for that game to go sideways on Oregon State if it can't stop San Jose State any better than it stopped UNLV or Nevada, or certainly Cal last time out. I think the Oregon State fans are a little bit punch drunk from watching the opposing team go up and down the field. And certainly that game in Berkeley a couple weekends ago, really bad showing from Oregon State. They were just non-competitive. Offense couldn't move the ball, couldn't run the ball, couldn't throw the ball. It was bad. And so I think Oregon State fans are a little nervous, understandably so, going into this game against San Jose State. But Oregon State's getting some guys back. San Jose State has got some problems itself. This isn't a bad opponent, and as I look at the four games left on the schedule, if I had to rank them in degree of difficulty from 1 to 4, the game against Air Force a week from Saturday would be the easiest game. San Jose State would be the second easiest game. Then comes Washington State on November 23rd, and I think the most difficult game left on the schedule is the season finale at Boise. So I think Boise State's going to need that game, and I think Oregon State is going to be in over its head. And so I think it's the next 2 weeks, and I think this is it. If you're going to get bowl eligible, you win this game against San Jose State, because I think next week you can beat Air Force on the road. Air Force is 1-7. They'll be 1-8 when you play them. I think this is it. This is the moment of truth for Trent Bray and Oregon State against San Jose State. Am I being too dramatic?
No, this is a must win. They have to win this game or they're not making the bowl game. That's for sure, because I'm with you. I think they can beat Air Force. Air Force is not a very good team, but I don't think they're beating Washington State or Boise State, especially Boise State at Boise in that final game. I feel like Boise is going to have everything to play for. Maybe they can sneak up and they can beat Washington State. I don't see it. So I think this is a must win. I don't think you're being dramatic at all. And this is going to be a tough game because San Jose State, we've seen the potential they have. Now, they have struggled as of late. They haven't been as good as they were when we saw them on the CW against Washington State, take them to double overtime. But Oregon State is still not fully healthy. And Trent Bray even said that, you know, yesterday when you talked to him. You know, Jaden Robinson will be back, which is going to be helpful. They're going to have some guys back because they had so many players out, especially on the defensive side in their two deep. But they're still not going to be fully healthy. So you look at the point spread, Beavers are favored by 3 points, so it's going to be a tight one. It's going to be a tight game, but you're right. It's a must win. If Oregon State's goal is to make a bowl game, which I think, you know, before the season, they probably were hoping for a little bit more, but I think you and me were both at about 6 or 7 wins. Like, to make a bowl game, you have to win this game. And so it is a must win. I don't think there's any real question about that.
I think, you know, look, a lot of times people will say in a 7-game series, they'll say, oh, it's the pivotal game 2 or the pivotal game 3. And we always go, and I always think, like, they're all pivotal. Like, they all equal the same. This case, if this is a 4-game series, these games don't hold equal weight. I don't think Oregon State can beat Washington State, and I don't think it can beat Boise State. I don't think the Beavers are good enough. But I think they can absolutely beat San Jose State at home, and I think they can beat Air Force. So Trent Bray's season, this is a pivot point. This is a pivotal moment. They've got to stop San Jose State. And when you do a deep dive on San Jose State, you know, it becomes evident that the Spartans have their own problems. They've got their two quarterbacks not happy with each other, not happy with the coaching staff. You know, their starter in that Washington State game that we both loved so much, right? We watched San Jose State play this great game against Washington State, and we all went, wow, they're fearless. They're great on offense. What a team. Like, this is wonderful. And then I all of a sudden was like, oh, wait a minute. Emmett Brown no longer starting all of a sudden. And all of a sudden, you're watching Walker Egett, the junior, get sort of the nod. And then in the last game out, Emmett Brown ends up, you know, coming off the bench, and he gets pulled from a possession, and he throws his helmet on the sideline, Steven. And I'm kind of wondering if we're going to see Emmett Brown. Like, I don't know. Like, did they fix that, or is that just a moment of frustration? Are you okay with a guy throwing his helmet? There were 4 interceptions in the game. Every quarterback they played 3 different quarterbacks, threw a pick against Fresno State. San Jose State is wobbling right now. And so this is the time to get them. They're getting them at the right time. And then when you look at San Jose State statistically, they have something that really benefits Oregon State. They have a stat that jumped off the page at me as I started to kind of evaluate the game. San Jose State has not had a running back rush for 100 yards in the game this season. And Oregon State hasn't stopped anybody in several weeks on the ground. And I kind of think Trent Bray and Oregon State, they have to be thinking, this is a game we can win. And so I just think it lines up nicely being at home against an opponent that you beat a year ago. Like, there's no shine on San Jose State. The quarterback problems, you're getting Jaden Robinson, some other guys back. If you're going to be bowl eligible, this is it. And if you're not, I think we're going to look back and we're going to say this is the one that got away.
I agree with you. San Jose State coming off a bye week as well, so maybe they have figured some things out. Maybe they had some injury problems that they didn't really know about. Now that they're getting a little healthier, I will say this: last couple games that San Jose State has played, they haven't guarded the pass very well. They haven't defended the pass very well, but they have defended the run decently. So that is, I think, a downfall for Oregon State. Like, they're going to need Javonte McCoy or Ben Gulbranson or whoever's playing there at quarterback to have a game and be able to throw the football. That is the one weakness on the Oregon State offensive side, is they haven't been able to throw the football. They can run the football, but can they throw it? I know San Jose State, for what it is on this season, they've been better against the run than they have the past. So we'll see what happens there. And also, San Jose State, 5-3, they're looking to make a bowl game as well. They play Boise State later this season. They play UNLV. Those are probably two losses. They play Stanford as well. So San Jose State may be looking at this game like, hey, this is a must win for us. Like, we need to win this game as well. If we want to get to bowl eligibility, we want to get to 6 wins. So I think it's not one of those things where motivation is going to be all on Oregon State's side. I think San Jose State's looking at this like, this may be the most winnable game that we have as well, going later on in the season if we want to get to bowl eligibility.
I can also tell you that, there was a moment, I think, as, I kind of look at Oregon State's season last 2 weeks ago when they're playing at Berkeley. There was a moment where I went, gosh, they're not very good. Like, this team's just not very good. And I started to go, what's going on with Ryan Gunderson, the offensive coordinator? Because I had felt all year that, they had at least started running the ball. Like, I've never really believed Oregon State at any point of this season could throw the ball very well. But I went, well, at least they've committed to running the ball. They've stayed true to their identity. But they didn't 2 weeks ago against Cal. It gives me pause. It's the one thing that, like, I think San Jose State's a good matchup for Oregon State. Games at Research Stadium. Some things that fall Oregon State's way. But if you can't run the ball against San Jose State and, you get yourself in a situation where your quarterback has to beat San Jose State throwing, you're not going to win this game. And so Trent Bray said it yesterday. I asked him, give us the key to the game, and he said, he didn't pause. There was no hesitation. He said, we got to run the ball. And so I believe they're in that situation. I think we're going to know pretty early in this San Jose State, Oregon State game. I think we'll figure out pretty early, what the issue is and whether or not they're going to be able to run the football or whatever it is. But I am very curious to see what happens on Saturday at Research Stadium, because it feels like that's Oregon State's season. Like, getting bowl eligible, that's what it was about. You can go out and you can sell that in recruiting, but that's, I think, what it is. We're going to get into the other games coming up, and we'll get into a conversation about Oregon and what they need to do besides winning. Washington going to Penn State in a whiteout situation at the beginning of the year. I said, oh, that is an ambush. That's going to be ugly. Now I'm kind of wondering about the psyche of Penn State football and James Franklin. Like, is this lining up nicely for Washington? We'll find out. And then what can Washington State do? Washington State plays a late game. What can they do in their game? And, Ashton Gentry, worried about his health at Boise State. Like, I was looking at his stats today, and I broke out the last two games that Boise State has played since he had kind of that injury where he went to the sideline. They taped his arm up, and I've looked at his yards per carry in the last two games since he had the forearm injury. Prior to the forearm injury, he was averaging almost 10 yards a carry. And since then, he's down around 3.8 yards a carry. 4 yards a carry. And it's really interesting to kind of see, like, something's not right with him, and we know it. And Boise State won't say it, but, you know, they still need him. So I'm just kind of wondering at what point, you know, will Boise State kind of pull him out of a game to let him get, you know, get some rest? Or will they, are they just going to go, look, we can't afford to pull him out of a game. He's got some kind of arm issue that's inhibiting him. You know, prior to the last two games, he had a 50-yard run or greater in every football game. It's amazing. And in the last two games, his biggest rushes were 18 yards and 35 yards. There's just something wrong with Ashton Gentry right now, and I think it's an injury. And I'm hoping it's not a broken arm that he's playing with, but he's playing hurt right now, and you can tell. And he's still good for 130 yards a game, playing hurt. It's just it's really been difficult, I think, to watch a guy that we all know is that talented. So Boise State getting back out there. What do they have to do, and what does it mean to his Heisman hopes if they go, hey, we need to try to win without him one game, or can they afford to do that? It kind of suggests to me the fact that he hasn't gone out. It suggests to me that the injury either isn't a season-ending type injury, or it's not something that can be fixed by taking a week off. And if it's the second thing, if he has a fracture and he's playing with a broken arm, I think it's going to go down as one of the biggest, most interesting stories of the season, as Boise State's chasing a playoff berth, and Ashton Gentry is playing hurt and trying to will his team to victory. All right, coming up, we got Punch It Audio. We'll get a visit from our friend David Fry, the son of Jerry Fry, who used to be the head coach of the Oregon Ducks. Leave it here.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
We're going to play some Punch It Audio coming up. Got a big weekend of college football ahead. We will talk to the son of former University of Oregon football coach Jerry Fry. David Fry will be joining us this hour. Steven's got the 5 at 5 coming up top of the hour. And then we'll launch you right into Thursday night football. Right here on the station you're listening to. Well, let's get on to it, Steven. How about we do a little Punch It Audio?
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
Presented by First Call Heating and Cooling.
Andy Staples talking about Colorado football. Colorado, Texas Tech coming up this weekend.
They gave up 506 passing yards to Abilene Christian, 426 to Cincinnati, 344 to TCU. When they've played fairly good quarterbacks, they have the quarterbacks have been efficient, and they have thrown for a bunch. Shador Sanders has better receivers and is a better quarterback than anybody they've played. Like, Colorado might lose this game, but if they lose this game, it's because Texas Tech and Baron Morton have a huge game and it's a shootout. Now, like, the Texas Tech-Iowa State game, it was a little bit limited offensively, but the weather was horrific in Ames. Like, it was not conducive to a shootout. This is a different situation.
Look, I get what Andy Staples is saying, but it comes down to a simple thing for me when I examine Colorado and Texas Tech. Colorado's got firepower on the offensive side of the ball that Texas Tech hasn't seen yet. It's that simple. I think it's a game, but I like Colorado in that game. Miller Moss, out of a job at USC, and now into the portal. But here's Lincoln Riley yesterday talking about it.
You know, he just got to be ready for the next opportunity. We never know how that's going to play out. I mean, I've had these play out where, you know, something like this happens, and a guy goes to another school and ends up playing in the NFL. I've had these happen where a guy sat down, didn't play for a little bit, and then went back in and played even better and took it over and took off and ran from there. I mean, listen, anything can happen, right? It's football. The tough thing is you don't know exactly what is going to happen. But, you know, if I know Miller, he'll stay in a really positive mindset. He'll come in.
I can't stand the thumping there. But listen, Lincoln Riley talking a day ago about Miller Moss being ready for the next thing. Miller Moss now into the transfer portal, and he's been benched, and Moss going into the portal. So we shall see. Is he going to Michigan? There's been some talk about Miller Moss being linked to Michigan, but clearly he is his time at USC is done.
I had read that Miller Moss in his final three in high school recruiting, Michigan was in their top three. And so we have had the reports of, you know, Dave Portnoy willing to spend money. We saw other reports of Michigan going after the freshman quarterback. So maybe they are in the mix for Miller Moss. I think that's where it's all coming from.
Well, I think the bigger thing is that these coaches know now if you bench a guy during this season, you run the risk of them leaving. And in this case, Miller Moss looks like he's got one foot out the door. Chris Vanini of The Athletic talking about BYU. He thinks the Cougars, who are undefeated, they're 8-0. He thinks they have a right to have a beef with the college football playoff rankings. Big 12 leader in the clubhouse looks vulnerable. Here's Chris Vanini.
In terms of teams that should be upset, I would say BYU. They've got two top 20 wins. They beat SMU on the road, and they beat Kansas State in a blowout. About a month ago, and yet they're only at 9. And yet the teams ahead of them, your Texases, your Penn States, your Tennessees, they don't have more top 20 wins or top 25 wins. They don't have the wins that BYU has. And I think that's the part that is maybe most concerning. Because, yes, BYU is the number 4 seed, and if they win the Big 12, they'll be fine. But I think this sets up a situation where the chances of the Big 12 getting two teams could be tough, because if BYU drops a game, they may not stay in that top 12. So the Big 12 may be looking at a one and in type of situation.
Chris Vanini basically pointing out that BYU is unhappy, I think, because they have played some Big 12 teams and won games. Look, I just don't think the Big 12 is getting a lot of respect. I don't think that people respect them right now, and I think the rankings reflected that. They are still ahead as the fourth potential conference champion of Boise State, and they're going to have some opportunities to prove that they belong in front of Boise State, but I think the committee was signaling to BYU that they just don't believe in them. Stephen A. Smith wants to run for president.
I have said this on many occasions. The answer would be hell no, because I like my life. Yeah. I'm living a pretty...
Enough politics for me. Let's move on. Shaq talking about NBA viewership. It's down because of all the three-point shots, says Shaq.
I have a theory that it's down because we're looking at the same thing. Everybody's running the same plays. The damn top of the key, dribble handoff. I was talking to a coach yesterday. He said they want to shoot 50 threes. But, you know, they were trying to contemplate if I could play in this era. And it's like, yo, Shaq, we would just shoot 53s. And I was like, well, how much you want to make? We want to make about 10 or 15 of them. I was like, well, that's not going to help you win. But I think everybody's looking at the same thing. And Steph Curry and those guys messed it up. Like, I don't mind Golden State back in the day shooting threes, but every team's not a three-point shooter. So why everybody has the same strategy? I think viewership will continue to go down unless we switch things back up.
I think it's more competition. I think the NBA is boring on most nights. I think some of it is the three-point shooting, but I think a lot of it is that, you know, we're watching the same sort of offensive pattern on both ends of the floor by all the teams. I don't mind the three-point shooting if, you know, one team or two teams are doing it really well and a different team's playing a different style, but everything now starts to look the same, and I find that, you know, it's just not as compelling as watching the NBA and other generations. I think Shaq's partly right, but it's not, you know, it's not just that one or two teams are doing it. It's that so many are doing it. J.J. Redick walks out of a news conference. He's upset. He's frustrated. Lakers coach. Cue it.
It's tough to have a, it's tough to have a bad shooting night. One. And then, you know, that that can, when it starts compounding, that can really start to weigh on you. I had some mental things that I would try to get myself out of it. But again, just speaking to me, there's times when you're in that and it's like, man, I'm never going to make another shot again. You know, that those thoughts come into your brain. You know, you have to have the sort of the mental toughness to just keep shooting and have the belief. I was, you know, I've told a number of players that I played with when I got older, I was like, I 8-for-12, you know, it's going to regress towards the positive at some point. I'm going to have an 8-for-12 night. And generally I did.
JJ, you're talking a lot about two or three guys, getting them to put in the effort. You talked a lot about wanting to play hard and LeBron being the guy that, that played hard in tonight's game. How do you address that with the team? What's your philosophy for approaching
that? I just did.
He's upset. J.J. Redick frustrated. He didn't like the question. I think in part because he didn't want to answer the question. I don't think it was an unfair question. But J.J. Redick learning life as an NBA coach. Not all about, you know, talking about shooting is fine. Talking about who didn't play hard, another thing. Christian McCaffrey expected to play. Is he? Well, Kyle Shanahan said it.
I do feel good one way or another. Okay. It's been two good days, and I mean, I'm not trying to, I mean, I'm just kind of messing around, but yeah. I mean, he's been awesome these last 2 days, so hopefully that continues to go and go well, and, you know, expect to get him out there, and, you know, you never know for a setback or anything, but mm-hmm. these 2 days have been great, and expect to see him out there.
I think the 49ers are hoping and wishing. Look, 49ers trying to get him back. Christian McCaffrey helps the entire offense, opens a lot up, helps the red zone offense. Moves the chains, gives them a dynamic playmaker. If anything has been learned in this time with Christian McCaffrey being sidelined for the 49ers, it's how valuable Christian McCaffrey is to the team. We'll see what he looks like when they get him back and to what extent he can play, but looks like he is trending positively. We shall see. Kurt Warner, meanwhile, picking the 49ers to win the NFC West. Nobody running away with it.
I'm going to lean towards San Francisco. Just because I've seen their guys, I've seen the consistency by which they play. If they get healthy and can get back to some semblance of that, that's the team from a consistency standpoint that I lean towards. The Rams to me are up and down and all over. Now, if you keep them in a game and you give Matthew Stafford the football late in the game, they can beat anybody. But he has been up and down. Like that game against Seattle, I didn't think they played very well in that game. They got some benefits from the turnovers, and then, you know, Seattle goes for it on fourth down and gives Matthew a chance, and he's going to make those plays over and over. But I just don't know if I feel comfortable with their team as a whole to say they're going to be there.
Well, I think one of the benefits that the 49ers have is that I think they've got more talent than the other teams in their division. And I think they're looking around going, look, if we can get pointed in the right direction, the benefit the Niners have to this point is not just the talent. It's just that nobody else is two games in front of them. You know, they've kept the field relatively close. Everybody's kind of even in that division. And, you know, they've blown at least two, maybe three games that they probably should have won. And I think they're looking now at, you know, trying to finish hard down the stretch. Every Super Bowl winning team in sort of the last few years has had a stretch of the season where they didn't play well. Unfortunate for the Niners, they had their stretch at the beginning of the year. They're not really affording themselves much of a margin. They've got to get it together. They've got to play well. But I agree with Warner and everybody else who's saying it. Like, you know, they've got more talent than anybody. Why wouldn't you pick them to be that team? All right, coming up, we're going to get into our picks. Steven and I will get into our picks a little bit later. In the show, we're also going to get a visit from David Fry here in the next segment of radio. He is the son of Jerry Fry, the longtime University of Oregon football coach. And often we see the coaches, we see Dan Lanning, right? And you get to know his family a little bit because Sophia, his wife, is designing uniforms. And his kids are with him on the field after the game. Or we talk about his children on this show when we interview him. Or you'll get to see Mario Cristobal and hear him talking about his children and his wife. And you know, but we don't really get to know the kids, do we? We don't get to know what their life is like. Mark Helfrich, I saw him with his children one or two times. Obviously, Chip Kelly at the time wasn't married, didn't have kids. But, Mike Bellotti had a son on the team. We got to know Luke a little bit in watching him play. But over the years, like, we've never really talked to the children about what it was like to grow up and be the son of the coach and go to school with kids, you know, sort of talking about the team and the game. I'm sure it was really cool in a lot of ways, but maybe not so cool in some ways as well. And so I've always kind of been curious to kind of check in with the families. And, you know, and I know when Mario Cristobal left to go, you know, move back to Miami and go back home and take over that Hurricanes program, I got an email from a dad who lived in Mario Cristobal's neighborhood and previously, I guess, had seen, Willie Taggart's family kind of move in, and now came Cristobal, and now came, you know, Dan Lanning. And the dad said that he was basically telling his kids, I don't want you to be friends with the coach's kids anymore. Not as a measure of being mean to them, but he was, I think, a little punch drunk in watching his children make friends and then having those friends pick up and move and leave. So what is that like? You know, our guest in the next segment, David Fry, is going to be able to talk about it. He has gone on to a successful career in broadcasting and is now hosting the Thanksgiving dog show that is on NBC, 23rd year it's been on. Jay Peterman from Seinfeld show, it's all I can talk him. It's the only way I can describe him, is his co-host as part of the event. David Fry is going to join us and talk about that event on NBC and, sort of what it is like to be the son of a high-profile figure in a town like Eugene. And, yes, it's different because those weren't college football playoff eras. Those weren't the Ducks on the cover of Sports Illustrated and ranked number one in the AP poll or in college football playoff poll. But I'm sure for a kid growing up in Eugene, it must have been very interesting to have your dad be the head football coach at the University of Oregon. So we'll talk to David Fry about that and get his perspective on that. We'll catch up on what he's doing now. His brother, Terry, went on to become a sports columnist in Denver at the Denver Post, and it went into sports media. And so it's interesting to see kind of where the family gravitated. But those Oregon staff, that Jerry Fry staff, really an interesting collection of coaches and assistants, and certainly set the table later for the Rich Brooks era into the Mike Bellotti era. So we'll talk with David Fry coming up here in a few minutes. And then Steven and I will get into our picks for the weekend. I'm still above 500, but I am clinging. I am like two games over 500 for the season, and I started off red hot. I think I was 12 games over 500 after the first week, and I have slowly seen my advantage melt away. I need a big week for the picks. And so, you know, I'm going full throttle. I'm picking with confidence this week. I'm not second guessing. I'm certainly not leaning into USC, who have killed me all year. Trojans have just killed me all season long. But I see a couple of upsets, and I'm picking one upset outright and another that I think is a pick 'em. And we'll get into all that. We'll talk about Oregon, Oregon State, Washington, Washington State, the Holy War, and more coming up. But up next, David Fry, the son of former Oregon coach Jerry Fry. He'll be joining us, and we'll dive deep on what it is to be the son of a coach in this region, in college football. So I think it'll be a fascinating conversation. And before I go to break, I just want to thank everybody who makes this show part of their day. I think that, you know, it's an incredible honor for me to be here. I've always felt that way. I've never, when I started doing sports radio, I never imagined that I'd be sitting here 18, 19, 20 years later and still hosting a show. And I'm humbled that the show is now on statewide down in Klamath Falls and Eugene and Roseburg and Medford and Bend and all over the state of Oregon and Southern Washington. It's awesome to talk and connect with so many people. Just feel really, really blessed to be able to do that on a daily basis. And I'm glad that you're here. I don't take it lightly that this is your diversion from whatever else you're doing in your life. So thank you for being here. All right, coming up, David Frye, leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
We got a lot of traditions on this show, a couple of decades of doing it. I didn't mean to get all sentimental on you in the last segment, but I won't do this forever. I just want you to know how much I appreciate it, that you're here and you're listening. Our next guest, David Frye, is one of our traditions because we bring him on every year in the month of November. Usually we try to line it up with kind of leading into Thanksgiving as he is going to be in his 23rd year as one of the hosts on the National Dog Show on NBC on Thanksgiving Day. His partner on the broadcast, Mr. Peterman, on the Seinfeld episodes, John O'Hurley is his name. They've been together since the beginning of the show, so 23 years. They are they're going to have about 25 million people watching this dog show. Before we get into any of the dog stuff, though, I want to bring David Frye on. I want to talk about, you know, what it was like to grow up as the son of Jerry Frye, football coach, University of Oregon. How you doing, David Frye?
I'm doing great, John. Thank you. It was great to grow up the son of Jerry Frye, but, you know, wandering around in Eugene, Oregon, there were a lot of eyes on me that I could walk through my dad's office the next day, and he would say, "What were you doing at the cooler last night?" You know, and always wanted. He always had another set of eyes out there watching on me, but it was great. It was great. It was fun to be a part of all the things that were going on at the University of Oregon Athletic Department. I tell everybody that I went to the University of Oregon for 17 years without graduating, sort of like John Belushi, in that, you know, from the time I was 6 or 7 years old, wandering around in the equipment room, picking up dirty towels and cleaning shoes and things. So it was a great part of it. And watching Bill Bowerman tear track shoes up and glue them back together. So every time I read something about the University of Oregon, I say, you know, I was there. I can tell you about that stuff.
Yeah, your dad was an assistant for Len Casanova and had been around the program for a while. I think it was about 11 or 12 seasons, and then he becomes the head coach of the program. What do you remember about that transition when Dad gets promoted to head coach?
I remember I was in high school at the time, and it was my senior year in high school. I was just coming off being the captain of the football team that year. And I remember he came home. He said, "They got a little secret to tell everybody in the family before it got anywhere else." And I shook his hand for quite some time because I was very excited about it. I had a lot of friends who had gone through the football program at Oregon, playing for Cavs, playing for my dad as an assistant coach. And I felt like it was just another move for the family that was fun for all of us to be a part of it.
Did the hours seem longer when he was a head coach, or were they just long in general because that's what coaching is?
They were pretty long in general. I know it was tough to find him during the season, especially at night. I think Thursday night was their night off, and he could come home and have family time. And, you know, but we were all into that. We all knew what was going on, and we all appreciated the hard work that he did all the time, and all of his assistant coaches that had a great staff of assistant coaches, guys that went on to become head coaches in the NFL, that, you know, guys like George Seifert and Gunther Cunningham and Norval Turner and people who went on to have great success. So I think it was fun to see those guys grow through the program too.
Your dad, you know, did not talk about his military service openly with his players. He had flown in combat. He had military service in World War II. You know, he had this gap between his sophomore and junior seasons at Wisconsin that was like 3 or 4 years. And, you know, he didn't talk about it with players. But did he talk with you and the family about World War II and what that was like?
You know, it's the greatest generation, the thing that Tom Brokaw wrote about. These guys just said, you know, we just did what we were told to do. And when I went in the Army, there were a lot of people that said, geez, I'm not going in, or I don't have to do this. I'm going to Canada, or I'm going to resist and not go in. And the thought never crossed my mind. And it took a long time for him to really come out with us and tell us what he had done in the war. He's seen 67 missions in the South Pacific. And he said, geez, I just did what I was told. He said, we flew this P-38 out there and took pictures of Japan and with the bombing damage or potential targets. And we feel like we were doing our job, but we never thought of it in terms of being, geez, we're going to help win the war. We just said, you know, you tell me to do it and I'll do it.
You know, growing up with a dad as a coach like that, and then also having the military part of it, how much of his military background do you think influenced his coaching and his parenting, or can you separate that ever once you've been through that as a person?
No, I think it was part of everything he did, whether it was parenting or coaching, and he was a great man. He really was, and it's easy for me to say that, of course, but I think his players knew that without it ever being printed in the duck dope, the guidebook, you know, for example, but they knew it and they appreciated him. You know, the football coach has a long hair. He didn't have long hair, but his son did. I had longer hair when I was a freshman, a sophomore in college, his first years of coaching college. And those were the years that he took a lot of grief from some high school coaches around the state for letting his players play with long hair. And it was just the kind of thing that was unthinkable in today's standards. God, if you didn't let guys play with long hair, you wouldn't have much of a team left.
We're talking with David Fry, who is the son of former University of Oregon coach Jerry Fry. Now, let's look at the kids, all right? You go on to become host of the National Dog Show. Your brother, Terry, writes a bunch of books and becomes a sports columnist. Judy goes into teaching. Susan is in ballet, right? And Nancy gets into, like, the legal world and is working at a law firm. Like, what a very diverse group of children that chose a bunch of different things. Like, I got to think mom played a role, given how busy dad was, in shaping your lives as well.
Mom was a very big part of what we were doing. I always like to tell the story about my mom. Who one time found out I was going out with somebody, and I spilled some vodka in my dad's football coach's car one night, and I had came home the next morning. My dad said, go clean my car out. I got to take my kek to breakfast. And my mom comes to me and says, what'd you spill in your dad's car? I said, oh, geez, Mom, I don't know, some 7-Up and maybe a little vodka. She says, vodka? She goes, what kind of girls are you going out with? It was not my fault. It was not my fault. It was the girl's fault. And that was
right. The
great story I told back to my mom when she was on her deathbed. And it brought us great closure to be able to talk about that. But, yeah, she was very much a part of it, too. And football coaches' wives have to be, because their football coach is gone a lot. And the football coach's wives work just as hard with that family as anybody.
What do you remember about the teams that Dad was coaching? Because you had guys like Dan Fouts that were in there and part of those teams. And did you see those guys? You know, were you in that circle, or were you like a lot of Oregon fans kind of watching it from the outside?
No, I was in the circle because I was going to the University of Oregon at that time. And my first year there as a freshman was his first year as the head coach. His first year as head coach was the first year that Austin Stadium was open. And so these guys are all guys that I would see once in a while in places where I couldn't tell my dad about it the next day. But those guys were my contemporaries. And when their hair got long, my hair was long. And that's not the only measure of what we did. But, you know, they were out there and they were part of the community and part of the team and very visible and very active in what went on. And when my dad passed, guys like Dan Fouts and Ahmad Rashad and Bobby Newland arranged for memorial services for my dad. That was, you know, 25 years after he had been at Oregon. So it was pretty amazing the impact that he had on these guys. It was the same impact that he had on me and my brother Terry and my sisters, Susan, Judy, and Nancy. And we're all proud of him, and we were thrilled to be a part of the family and part of the University of Oregon football program.
What do you remember of the opening of Autzen Stadium? Were you there for the first game?
I was there for the first game. It was you know, it looked like a big piece of concrete out there, and it didn't. I mean, my God, I've been back and I've seen pictures of it here lately as well. It's unbelievable for a stadium that cost, I don't know what, $2 million to build originally. And the things that are there now and the things that they do, the reputation that it has as a football facility. And it's just unbelievable to me how far it had come. I remember what a big deal it was that when he became the head coach, and it was the first, his first game as head coach was the first game played there. And it was, we probably didn't have any idea of how it was going to grow and become such a big deal. And it was just a place for us to go to games.
We're talking to David Fry, who will be hosting the National Dog Show on NBC on Thanksgiving, 23rd year doing it. The son of former Oregon football coach Jerry Fry. You and John O'Hurley, Mr. Peterman on Seinfeld. Well, you guys are a good 1-2 punch. You guys been doing this together for, is this 23 or 22 years? I mean, did you imagine at that first or second year, hey, we're going to do this for forever?
No, we didn't, but we knew it was going to be fun because we fell into a perfect time slot on Thanksgiving Day right after the Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade. But it was in a time slot, a 2-hour time slot that NBC had open because they had walked away from football, from the NFL football, and they were playing It's a Wonderful Life. And they were getting, you know, they were drawing like 800,000, 900,000 people in their audience. We did the dog show. First of all, the senior vice president for NBC Sports, John Miller, watched the movie Best in Show, and he said, hey, "I'm going to do a dog show on Thanksgiving Day." And he went in on Monday morning after he'd seen the show, and said to Dick Ebersol, NBC Sports guy, he says, "I want to do a dog show in there," and he got laughed out of the office. And eventually, he got through the NBC Entertainment people. And we got the dog show, and the first year we did it, we drew 19 million viewers, and that was in 2002. My God, we draw the Ducks. The Ducks had 13 million people watch their game with Ohio State this year, and that doesn't touch what we do with the dog show. We're now up close to 25 million people every year watching the show, and it's unbelievable. I mean, 23 years, first of all, with John, it's lasted longer than some of my wives. But it just is something that is a great, it falls in a great family holiday, and it's a subject that appeals to everybody in the family. We all have dogs, and it becomes something for everybody to target. So I'm going to watch, it's the alma mater factor. If I'm not a Brittany, I'm going to watch the show and root for the Brittany. It's like I root for the Ducks every week. So it's become a great part of what we do on Thanksgiving Day.
Well, you know, for my youngest two daughters, it becomes, which dog are we getting next? You know, and so they kind of watch it and they go, okay, that's the one we want, you know, and I'm like, no, you already have your dog, but we'll file that away.
Have them call me, John. We'll take care of them. And that's part of the deal is educating people to try to find the dog that fits their lifestyle and fits their family the best. And we think we do a lot of that on the telecast.
Now, over the years, like, you know, you did the Westminster show on USA Network, I think, for a number of years as well. And you had, I remember Joe Garagiola. Joe was on that. Joe G was on that. Bud Collins was on that. Mary Carrillo was on that. you really gravitate to this.
Well, you know, they gravitate to me. I mean, I'm the dog guy. These guys come in and they have a dog and they come in and they think this will be fun. And they come in and they have a great time because they're just like everybody else. And as the John Madden of dog shows, as my publicist calls me, I'm the guy that's supposed to answer the questions that they have that are really the same questions that people at home are watching and trying to figure out, what's the deal on that poodle haircut, Dave? Tell me the answer to that. And we try to educate our viewers as to what the basis is for things like haircuts and shapes and sizes and colors and eyes and things like that. And we think we do a good job of that, telling that to the TV audience that everything within the show dog world, we're talking about relating form to function. And the dog has to have the right form to do the function it was bred to do. And that's what we're looking at. And that's what the judge looks for.
And the characters that are around the dog show, obviously you mentioned the movie Best in Show. I mean, I like that when I tune in and watch you guys, you are having a good time with it, and you do poke fun at yourselves, and you poke fun at the spectacle of the dog show while doing the dog show. So I don't think it's that far removed from the mockumentary Best in Show. I think we lost David Fry on that note. We'll try to get him back. Punch him back up. Is David Fry there? Is he there? Are you there? Okay, we lost you.
We're back. Yeah,
I thought I offended you with my question. No, it's what I like about it is you guys don't take yourself too seriously either. And you mentioned Best in Show, which is like a mockumentary. So, you know, I like the fact that you guys will have some fun with kind of the characters around the dog show, because if you've ever been to a dog show, it's not that far removed from the truth.
Well, we said that all the time when the movie was coming out in the dog show world. We talked about it, and we were a little concerned because there was some talk that it was going to be about a judge being on the take or something. And when the movie came out, they didn't make fun of the dogs and they didn't make fun of the sport. They only make fun of the people. And we admit to being a pretty target rich environment in that regard. But it's true of anything. You go to tailgating before a ball game, you see all these people, they're characters that you say, I see this guy over here, or I saw this guy across the lot, and I know who these guys are. And we love our dogs. And that's what it's all about, is the relationship with the dogs. We show them, you know, we dress them up a little bit and take them to dog shows, so to speak. But if we all have dogs and we all love our dogs, a dog walks into the room and the energy changes. And that's what our life is all about with our show dogs and our therapy dogs, other things that we're involved in, that makes it fun for everybody in the family.
David Fry, I appreciate you. Catch you on NBC on Thanksgiving Day and the National Dog Show.
Noon to 2, every time zone. So thanks, John. Thanks for having me on. It's always fun. Go Ducks.
You bet, man. Thanks for catching up. There he goes, David Fry. Good stuff. Great background on being a kid of a coach. Get a little flavor there, and you can catch him on NBC on Thanksgiving Day, noon to 2. Leave it here. We're going to talk about the games this weekend coming up, plus the 5 at 5.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750, The Game.
Oregon has got a very winnable football game this week at Autzen Stadium. Big number in the point spread. I don't think this is going to be much of an aberration week to week for Oregon here until the end of the regular season, or maybe the Washington game to finish the season. But Oregon's at 24.5-point favorite at home against Maryland. Ducks are number one in the college football playoff rankings. I don't see a trip here. I don't see a trap. I don't see a trip. I don't see a problem. I see a patsy, though. Maryland is perfect. And barring some kind of psychological fracture or letdown, I think Oregon's defense is going to feast again this week, as they have in now, 7 of 9 weeks, they've held the opposition to 14 or fewer points. Dan Lanning's team is humming. I like the Ducks. I like the Ducks to blow out Maryland. I think they're going to cover the 24.5 points. I think it's like a 42-14 game. Steven?
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't see this being a game that the Ducks trip up, and I'm with you. I think the Ducks should relatively have an easy road to go 12-0 and get to the Big Ten title game, as long as, you know, Indiana loses and they can get the number one seed and no one else stumbles up. So, yeah, I'm with you. I think Ducks handle business here. I think the one game you would worry about right now is at Wisconsin, but I don't think they're that good, so I'm with you. Ducks big over Maryland this week.
Yeah, I think you're going to see double-digit point spreads throughout the rest of the regular season for Oregon till they get to the Big Ten title game and on to the playoff. Utah State 2-6 at Washington State 7-1. Saturday 7:30 on the CW. I'm gonna keep hammering this, but style points matter. Style points matter. Style points matter. And I think just the same way in which I have Oregon covering the 24.5 against Maryland, Washington State is a 20.5-point favorite against Utah State. Cougars are at home. I don't think Utah State can stop Washington State. I think it's something like 50-21. I think there's going to be a 5 or a 6 in Washington State's first digit on the scoreboard. I think they have a chance to put up 60 here this week against Utah State. But I picked it 50-21. Washington State covering the 20.5 points.
You know what? I'm going to go with Utah State plus the points. I think Washington State wins. I think they win pretty easily. But you look at their schedule. They beat Hawaii by 32, but San Diego State won by 3, beat Fresno State by 8, lost to Boise, beat San Jose State by 2, beat Washington by 5. Like, they've played close games this season. They have John Mateer, who is so explosive, but that defense of Washington State, I still do question how good they really are. I think Utah State can score enough to stay within the number, but I think Washington State wins, but Utah State covers.
San Jose State at Oregon State, 12:30 Saturday, FS1. The Beavers are a 3-point favorite in this game. I kind of wondered if this would be like a 1.5 or a 2. I still like Oregon State. Oregon State's getting some players back. Jade Robinson's told us earlier in the show he's back. San Jose State has not had a 100-yard rushing game from a running back this season. They've also got a weird thing going on at quarterback with Emmett Brown and Walker Egitt, who are splitting time. Neither one of those guys has looked comfortable. I like Oregon State in this game coming out of the bye week. I'm not 100% confident because I've watched Oregon State in the last month like you have, but I'll take Oregon State something like 27-23. A close game, but they cover.
I don't feel good about this one, John. I'm with you because we're coming off the last game we saw Oregon State against Cal, and that was not a good effort. And yeah, you downed a lot of guys, but it wasn't a good effort. And so you do wonder, are they checked out? I don't think that they are. I think Trent Bray can get some up. You hear Jaden Robinson, he's ready to go. They're getting healthier. I believe in Trent Bray and this coaching staff can get this team motivated. So for that reason, I will take Oregon State and lay the points. But I think there is a question of, you know, they're 4-4. They're not gonna, you know, they're missing out on all the big time games, all the big time bowl games. Is making a bowl game big enough motivation? I think it is. I think Oregon State could win this game by 10, but I do have a little question in the back of my mind.
Washington's going to Penn State, 5:00 Saturday. It's on Peacock. When they announced this one, I gave the Huskies no chance to win it. But then, you know, Penn State has this weird game against Ohio State. James Franklin is arguing with fans in the stands. It's this matchup starts to look more and more intriguing. So I'm kind of looking at this one going, Penn State's a 13.5 point favorite. I think this is going to be like a one score game. I think Penn State wins, but I'll take Washington and 13.5. If I've learned anything, Huskies keep burning me because they play close. And I don't think Penn State is built to run away from anybody. I think it's 27-20 or 20-17 or 21-14, but 13.5 is too many points.
I disagree with you. I think Penn State puts them on Washington. I don't know how much Washington can score in this game. The Huskies 0-3 on the road this season. They lost at Rutgers. They lost at Indiana. They lost at Iowa. They lost at Iowa by 24 points. I think that's what it could be like in this one. I think Penn State takes back kind of, you know, the mentality they had before. It's a whiteout. I think that's going to affect Washington a little bit. So give me Penn State and I'll lay the points.
Alabama, LSU, 4:30 Saturday, ABC. Now, I look at Alabama. Their two losses this year came against teams that ran the ball really effectively. Vanderbilt rushed for 166 yards against Alabama. It was good enough. Tennessee got 214. I'm looking at LSU's run game. They are the number 111 rushing team in the country. LSU doesn't run the ball. Give me Alabama, because Alabama's favored by 3, and I think Alabama's going to cover. So I'm going to lay the 3. I think Alabama wins this game. They beat LSU, and they cover the 3.
I love your thought process, because Kalen DeBoer, he's much better than Brian Kelly. Now that Brian Kelly's bad, but DeBoer, man, he is elite. I'm going to be opposite, though. And the reason why, LSU at night, man, that is a spooky place at it night. Is. Weird things happen.
They do.
This Alabama defense, yes, it has improved since that loss or the win against Georgia where they gave up, you know, 35 or whatever it was in the second half. They have improved, but I don't think that they're great. And I think LSU will score just enough. Night at LSU, Death Valley, man. I'm going to go LSU in this one.
I want to see Brian Kelly mad at the end of the game.
That is fun. It is fun to watch.
You want to see that happen. All right, let's do a couple more here. Central Florida's at Arizona State. This one's on ESPN2. Central Florida was 3-0 to start. They lost 5 straight. And it wasn't a mystery why they lost five straight. They played good teams. That's why they couldn't find wins in that five-game losing skid. And then they finally, they get an easier opponent last week, Arizona, and they win. And so UCF is like Mendoza. It's the Mendoza line. Are you good? If you're good or decent, you're going to beat Central Florida. I like Arizona State to beat Central Florida. I think it's a relatively fun game. It's like 31-27, but ASU will cover the field goal that they're favored by. I'll take Kenny Dillingham to get win number seven.
The question is Scataboo playing? Because he has been injured. He is he's questionable in this game. There are questions if he plays. So if Cam Scataboo is not playing, I cannot pick Arizona State. I think he's a baller, though. So I think he'll play. And give me Arizona State to win on the road, because I'm with you. UCF, man, they're one of those teams where I feel like if they're playing a below-average team, they're going to crush them. If they're playing an above-average team to a good team, that's when they kind of struggle. Give me Arizona State, man. Kenny Dillingham, what a job he has done down in Tempe.
I want to talk about Colorado because this is an interesting game. 6-2 Colorado playing at 6-3 Texas Tech. This game's on Fox on Saturday. The Colorado's a 4-point favorite in the game. Buffaloes are already bowl eligible. They're looking for more. I know when the playoff rankings came out, they looked at it and went, okay, how do we get in there? I just think that, you talk about offense, defense, special teams. Colorado's offense is the best unit on either side of this game. And I think they're going to score 30-plus on Texas Tech. Now, I like Texas Tech, and they're coming off a huge upset win over Iowa State. But I don't like this matchup for Texas Tech. I think this is Colorado's game. I think Colorado goes to Lubbock. I think they win. I think it's 34-28.
I think Texas Tech pass defense has been terrible this season. Like, absolutely awful. And for that reason, I think Shedeur can be able to carve them up. 125th right now in the nation in passing yards given up to their opponents, Texas Tech. And that's what Colorado's strength is. They're going to come in and they're going to pass the football. It's going to be a higher scoring game. But the Colorado offensive defensive line has been so much better this season than what we thought it was going to be coming in. I've been down Colorado all season long. I'm not anymore. I think they're 7-2. I think they're going to win out and go 10-2.
One more game. Let's do a quick one. Let's go to Nevada, Boise State. Boise State's a 24-point favorite. This one falls in my style points, mantra. I like Boise State big over Nevada, 48-17.
10 seconds left, and I got Nevada plus the points. Boise State wins, but Genty a little limited.
Wow, let's see how that goes. Leave it here, the 5 at 5 next.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Well, we build all show for this moment. The 5 at 5, the 5 biggest stories going on in sports. We're going to lead you right into Thursday Night Football. But what are the 5 biggest stories? And what do I have to say about them? Well, let's go.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Well, University of Florida, John, they're okay, 4-4 on the season, but they have already announced that they're going to stick with Billy Napier as their head coach going into next season. It'll be his fourth season. Scott Strickland, the AD at Florida, said he wanted to let you know that Billy Napier will continue to be the head coach of the Florida Gators. He said that in a statement today. Now, Florida has been more competitive this season. We saw that against Georgia last week. They blew out Kentucky. They were up over Georgia until their star freshman, DJ Lagway, left the game with a hamstring injury. I kind of think that that's the reason why they wanted to keep Napier. Napier has a good relationship with Lagway, who is one of the top recruits coming into the nation this season. But in his 3-plus season with Florida, Napier 15-18, 8-13 in SEC play. That seems like fireable offense, but they're going to bring it back for one more year.
Yeah, I think you're going to see a lot of this in college football. There's so much uncertainty right now about how the House settlement is going to affect revenue sharing between the teams and the players and the schools. And I think having to be amid a coaching search where you're trying to figure out how to tier your non-football sports, your Olympic sports, I think there's just a lot out there. And I think you're going to see a lot of athletic directors who decide to punt this offseason. And I don't think we'll see the normal rapid reaction. I think the real coaching carousel will spin a year from this summer, a year from this December, as these ADs are still trying to figure out where they're headed and how they're going to pay for it all. They don't want to be amid a coaching search. So I think you'll see some schools that will stick with coaches in this hiring cycle.
Number two.
Well, another coach who might be on the hot seat is Lincoln Riley, but he will not have his quarterback, Miller Moss, anymore, as Miller Moss had been benched earlier this week for Jaden Mayava, transfer from UNLV. But now Moss, according to sources, is entering the transfer portal in the middle of the season. USC started out the season so hot this season, beat LSU at the start. Miller Moss, they were talking of him, Heisman, top 25, but he's going to enter the portal after losing his starting job. Michigan reportedly on the top of his list as of right now. As Miller Moss was interested in Michigan coming out of high school, but USC, they lost Bear Alexander earlier in the season. After he lost some playing time, he hit the portal. Now Miller Moss hitting the portal right in the middle of the season.
It's interesting because it's the same Miller Moss who was like the hero after the LSU game at the beginning of the season.
And the Louisville game. Remember the bowl game? He threw five or six touchdowns.
And not now. And so, look, I think this is Lincoln Riley obviously making a change, trying to figure out what he's going to do next year. But beyond that, this is a player, like a lot of other players who are going to be told, you're not in our immediate plans. They're going to immediately jump into the portal.
Do you think it has anything to do with any NIL money type of thing? Sluka at UNLV?
No. If I'm not in your plans, why am I going to put myself out at practice? Why am I going to put myself in danger? Why am I going to put myself in your program for another day if I'm not your guy? You're going to see this with quarterbacks. You already saw some other key position guys who don't want to give up eligibility, who will jump in there before the four games expire and you burn the year of eligibility. But I think this is just about a quarterback who's saying, hey, I'm on the open market. I don't like what's happening here. I'm getting out now. I'm not waiting to the end of the season. I think you'll see more of this.
Number three.
Kyle Shanahan didn't confirm that Christian McCaffrey is going to play, but he basically said Christian McCaffrey is going to be available to play on Sunday. Earlier today, this was during the show, he actually went on a radio show and said that McCaffrey looked great, looked excellent during practice, and he should be available. Here's exactly what Shanahan had to say.
I do feel good one way or another. Okay. It's been two good days, and I'm just kind of messing around, but yeah. I mean, he's been awesome these last 2 days, so hopefully that continues to go well, and expect to get him out there, and you never know for a setback or anything, but mm-hmm. these 2 days have been great, and expect to see him out there.
Looks great, kind of exactly what the 49ers need, a little bump in their chest there.
Look, the Niners need Christian McCaffrey. It's evident that their offense is not the same without him. He adds such a dimension. He makes everybody better. We can talk about the receivers and we can talk about Brock Purdy all we want. This offense hasn't been the same, and we're about to find out how much of that has to do with Christian McCaffrey.
Number four.
We're on opposite sides of the LSU-Alabama game this week. I like LSU. You like Alabama, but it's going to be down in Death Valley, and LSU, they had discontinued their decade-long tradition of having a live tiger as their mascot, Mike, in Tiger Stadium. They stopped that in 2015. Well, Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry, he is making it come back. He has publicly advocated for the return, and according to multiple sources, Landry is going to make it happen. Now, LSU has even pushed back on this idea. They don't like the fact they feel that the tiger, can have potential trauma being in front of 100,000 screaming fans. And in the past, cheerleaders have induced the live tiger to roar by stomping or beating the cage repeatedly. Yeah. And then the more recent years, they'd put a stuffed tiger in front of the cage to provoke him. So there has been university concerns as well as PETA and 50,000 of their 50,000 of their followers. They've already called for Landry to leave the cats alone. But instead, Landry, he has facilitated the delivery of a tiger from an out-of-state refuge to assume the role for Mike, as Mike 7 will be in his regular habitat across the street from Tiger Stadium. But the governor, he needs a live tiger for this game for Alabama versus LSU.
Look, I don't like it, and it's not because I'm so, hey, let's leave the animals alone activist. I'm not that person, but I don't like it because it's unnecessary. This is just ridiculous. I don't think any of these teams really need a live animal to be part of the festivities at the stadium. I get it. It's all kind of cool to see Ralphie the Buffalo run out onto the field, but it's like it's a 5-7 second thing. the juice isn't worth the squeeze in this case. Another story involving animals that caught my eye today was it came out of South Carolina. I don't know if you saw the story, but 43 monkeys escaped a research facility in South Carolina, and police there are telling the residents around the research facilities to keep their doors and their windows locked. This is Planet of the Apes, man. These monkeys are on the loose, and I can't help but think inside job when I see 43 monkeys escaped. Like, one monkey escapes, we go, okay, somebody got out. 43 monkeys escape, we go, who did it? Who left the door open? Like, somebody let the monkeys out in South Carolina. Can you think of anything more terrifying than having an Amber Alert or your phone go off and they say, keep your windows and doors locked. Residents are strongly advised to keep your doors secured and your windows secured to prevent these animals from entering homes. I have so many questions. Among them, what were the experiments being done on the monkeys? Because if these monkeys are out there, I need to know. Are they radioactive? How mad are they? What are we talking about here? Can you imagine?
No, I can't. That is terrifying. And again, it goes back to our whole theory about the water. Like, it's me with animals as well. Like, I'm not messing with these animals. They are going to dominate me no matter how they want to. And you're right. Like, what experiments are going on? Are these super monkeys? Are they just regular monkeys? We have no idea. They probably can open doors.
Well, they have one of these facilities out in Hillsboro that there's been multiple news stories about. But the caretakers say that somebody failed to secure a door at the enclosure that allowed the monkeys to roam free. They called it, quote, follow the leader. You see one go and the others go. Apparently, it was 50 monkeys. 7 stayed behind. 43 ran for it.
That's sus, man. Someone let him out.
It feels a little bit.
Number 5.
Well, anytime I can take a shot at Travis Kelce, I'm going to. Now, of course, Travis Kelce and Jason Kelce, they've been in the news lately, but he was Travis, the tight end on the Chiefs. He was the subject of a Jeopardy question, John. I want you to listen to this. Listen to how they kind of take a shot at Travis here.
The T-Show in question 200.
Are you smarter than a celebrity is hosted by this man, who's maybe more famous as a boyfriend than as a 3-time Super Bowl champ? Derek.
Who's Travis Kelce?
Correct.
More famous as a boyfriend than a Super Bowl champion. I kind of thought that was really funny, and I liked it a lot.
Shots fired at Travis Kelce. Always love to see Jeopardy include a little bit of sports, and I always am. I always feel smarter when the contestants can't answer the Jeopardy
questions. I was
going to
say, are you surprised they got that question right, or was it too easy by, are you smarter than a fifth grader and the boyfriend part?
Well, it hits on a number of things. Like, it's not just a sports question, because Travis Kelce's involved, you all of a sudden have, like, the Taylor Swift crowd in on it, you know? So I think in a lot of ways, people always joked when they started dating, she wasn't anybody until she started dating a football player. But Travis Kelce's profile's been elevated.
He's a question on Jeopardy now. That is, that's high class.
He's made it, you know, and people are harassing his brother, and people know who his mother is. And this is, there's a halo effect to the Swift thing. All right. Appreciate everybody who's listened to this show. I think I said it earlier. I'm going to say it again. I am humbled that you're out there. It means a lot to me that you include this show as part of your day, so thank you. And we're going to be back tomorrow with another great show. We're going to lead you right into Thursday Night Football here. If you want a podcast of this show, go to Apple Podcasts and grab it. You want to read me, you know where to find me, johncanzano.com. That's where you can read me now exclusively.